value.
Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segments, Wells Fargo Home Lending. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
But we begin tonight with January 6th, today's date, which used to hold an unremarkable place on the political calendar. The ceremonial day when every 4 years Congress certifies the foregoing presidential election. Certification day remained unremarkable for 245 years, a mere formality that barely anyone noticed until 2021, when Donald Trump, having been tossed out of the presidency by 81 million voters following a failed first term that included a million COVID deaths and a recession, refused to accept being fired by the American people and instead, embarrassed by having lost to Joe Biden, lied to his enraged and disappointed supporters, telling them he hadn't lost at all, that the election had been stolen from him and from them by various phantoms, illegal immigrant voters, black and brown voters in swing state big cities, diabolical Democrats, the deep state, the voting machines themselves, and maybe even the ghost of Hugo Chavez. And with that big lie, Trump summoned his most ardent supporters to the Capitol.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong. And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
The president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't even care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me.
I couldn't believe my eyes. There were officers on the ground, you know, they were bleeding. They were throwing up. They were, you know, they had, I saw friends with blood all over their faces. I was slipping in people's blood.
And from that day on, after more than 4 hours of hell, in which Trump sat in the White House watching on TV and throwing ketchup at the wall, as mobs of his supporters sacked the Capitol, injuring police officers, five of whom would wind up dead, alongside multiple Trump fans, one of whom got trampled by the mob and another shot by a police officer while trying to force her way into the speaker's lounge where terrified Congress members and young staffers were hiding. From that day on, this became the lasting memory and meaning of January 6th. This officer standing at the top of the stairs, tricking the mob into going left instead of right where the Congress members were hiding. This officer was trapped in a doorway, screaming for his life. These senators evacuating fleeing for their lives, including this Missouri Republican, Josh Hawley, who you see circled, who just hours before fleeing in terror was throwing his fist up to the crowd like he was one of them. These Republican members cowering behind the House chamber door under the protection of a Capitol Police officer whose service they would later refuse to honor with votes in favor of congressional gold medals because they feared it would anger their Trumpy base. And these images, the so-called QAnon shaman and his fellow goons taking over the Senate chamber, a highly restricted area to the public, including this guy who brought zip ties, and this old man who ransacked then Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office and then took a seat in her chair with his dirty feet up on her desk. This still unarrested person who left pipe bombs outside the Democratic and Republican committee headquarters. And of course, the noose the insurrectionists brought with them to Washington to hang Vice President Mike Pence with, over his refusal to commit a federal crime by pretending that Trump's fake electors were real and the real electors were invalid.
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
This is January 6th. From that day forward. And pretending that this is no longer what today means is, to put it bluntly, an insult to every cop that was injured that day, every terrified congressional staffer and member, every Capitol worker who had to clean up the feces the Trump mob smeared on the walls, and to every decent notion anyone ever had about this country. It's also a lie. It's a lie most Republicans and even some in the media want to tell you because it makes Republicans feel better. And apparently making Republicans feel better is really important. Since while their elected officials hid in terror with every single Democrat, the party itself very quickly changed their minds, led by Trump and their favorite billionaire news channel, Rupert Murdoch's Fox. They created a new big lie that January 6th was just a normal tourist occasion and really not that big of a deal. Well, you know what? Sorry, but it was a big deal. It was an insurrection, the first violent sacking of our Capitol since the War of 1812. Trump's second impeachment was literally for the incitement of an insurrection. And the idea of forgetting that, of just moving on and pretending there's no harm, no foul, and preparing to quietly reinstall the chief insurrectionist without comment, is frankly a shameful idea. The fact that so few voters found his actions disqualifying, the Supreme Court conservatives' negation of the Constitution's insurrection clause so our shameless Chief Justice John Roberts could clear the way for his reelection, all of it is, sorry, utterly shameful. Today is not a day to commemorate. Yes, we've got to do it because that's what some of y'all voted for or failed to vote and cleared the way for, but for God's sakes, let's at least have the decency and dignity to be a little embarrassed. Embarrassed for the most cynical of political parties, for their supposed dear leader, for his billionaire bosses who paid to reinstall him, and for anyone who dismissed January 6, 2021 as not a deal breaker for the man for whom the violence occurred to be president again. You do realize the rest of the world can see us, right? And 14 days from today, you will hear many soberly and reverently laud the peaceful transfer of power. Well, I hate to be the fly at the picnic table, but you can't peacefully transfer power to an insurrectionist simply because it took them an extra 4 years to finish the job. This was a violent transfer of power, the most violent in U.S. history, if we're being honest. Joining me now is Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi, former chair of the January 6th Select Committee and ranking member of the Committee on Homeland Security. Congressman, it is wonderful to see you. And I want to give you an opportunity. You have just heard what I think about today, and I would like for you to tell us how you feel on today.
Well, obviously, what you saw today is how the process is supposed to work. The certification is a formality that's required. The vice president is supposed to preside, and obviously the results are the results. Well, 4 years ago, that was not the case. Former President Trump invited people to come to Washington and told them it would be wild. And so when that occurred, and a lot of us were involved in it, it became crystal clear that we have to fix this. So Congress directed the formation of the January 6th Select Committee to look at the facts and circumstances. And for almost 2 years, we did that. We produced a report. Some people didn't like the report, but Joy, it stands for itself. Now, if those individuals who had a problem with it could have come during our work, they could have testified, but they had to do it on the oath. AFTA is who they are now. What they are saying has no significance whatsoever in our work product. So I can tell you what people saw with their own eyes really happened. I can tell you that Donald Trump made the inquiry for people to come. And I can tell you that the work of our committee stands on its own. And so here we are 4 years later. Our democracy survived. Part of that survival is a lot of us are committed, even in losing an election, to do it the right way. And so I said in the halls today, Jamie Raskin and myself, I'm wearing the tie that I wore 4 years ago when all this craziness occurred. But it's still the symbol of democracy. We have to go with it. It is a sin and shame that Donald Trump is trying to rewrite history. It was a bad day. I don't care what he says. It's a black mark on this country. And what we have to do, Joy, is get it right. And getting it right is not retribution on the part of those people you don't like. This is a democracy. And Donald Trump has to understand it's more than just who he is. We are a nation of laws. We are not a nation of what one thinks. And so as a black man from Mississippi, I understand when government is used against its own people. It took my United States government, the free people who look like Bennett Thompson, to have the right to vote. So I look for my government to do what's right, not what people think should be. And so Donald Trump has to grow up. He has to be the adult. He's a commander in chief, and he needs to move in that direction.
Anyone who's in the sound of my voice, the January 6th rioters are getting off easy. Privilege. Lawmakers from both sides of the political aisle have denounced the storming of the Capitol as an act of domestic terrorism. But 4 years after the insurrection, prosecutors have rarely asked judges to impose the harsh sentences that federal law recommends for defendants motivated by politics. It has a political motivation. What is that? It's the same type of charges for the man in New Orleans. It's the same type of charges for Oklahoma City. It's the same charges. With the ism. T-E-R-R-O-R-I-S-M. That's what it should be. But you guys are so concerned about, oh my gosh, from overseas and the foreign and the Muslims. What about the homegrown ones? Right in your backyard. With the MAGA hats. Instead, even as some judges have publicly debated whether the charges against January 6th defendants qualify as crimes of terrorism, prosecutors have repeatedly pulled back on tougher sentences, citing unspecified facts and circumstances. The sentencing enhancement for terrorism crimes was created as a result of legislation Congress passed following the 1993 boom in the parking, I have to be careful of the algorithm, in the parking garage at the World Trade Center. The provision initially applied only to crimes linked to international T-word. But after the bombing of the Oklahoma, after the boom of the Oklahoma City federal building in 1995, Congress moved to expand the enhancement to cover the T-word inspired purely by domestic causes. The biggest form of the T-word is domestic, homegrown, right-wing, radicalized, white nationalist, white men mostly. That is according to the head of the FBI, who is a Republican Donald Trump appointee, Christopher Wray. Terrorism-related language now includes federal criminal offenses calculated to influence or affect the conduct of government by intimidation or coercion, or to retaliate against government conduct. Sounds like it to me. Does it sound like it to you? Obviously, January 6th qualifies as domestic terrorism, and yet the DOJ is not prosecuting cases, by the way. Cases that way, I should say. And that is a big deal. Invoking those enhancements typically adds about 15 years in prison to defendant's recommended sentence, setting the minimum calculation at 17 and a half years. Merrick Garland, the Biden Justice Department, letting off January 6th insurrectionist terrorists with lower sentencing, lower charges. They should, the minimum of 17 and a half years. That's why I say they should rot in prison. But oh my God, they're being overcharged and the Biden Justice Department is, the Biden Justice Department is letting these people off easy. Do you think that a Trump Justice Department would have done that for black and brown people if they were Democrats doing the same thing? White privilege again, once again. Don't get me started. Don't get me started. And the people are afraid to say that. That's exactly what this is. But somehow, people of a certain hue can do things, and it's not considered unpatriotic. It's not considered the T word. It's not considered treason. I'm going to play a short timeline. I'm going to play some of it on what happened on that day, because I want you to know. I want you to watch it. I want you to watch it. Here it is.
I am not allowed to say what's going to happen today because everyone's just going to have to watch.
Yeah, this was organic, right? I'm not allowed. This is organic.
Something's going to happen.
Thank you.
Who breathes our streets? Who breathes our streets?
I
hope Mike is going to do the right thing. I hope so. I hope so. Because if Mike Pence does the right thing, we win the election. All Vice President Pence has to do is send it back to the states to recertify, and we become president, and you are the happiest people. Mike Pence is going to have to come through for us, and if he doesn't, that will be a sad day for our country.
Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength, and you have to be strong.
Cruiser 50, it does look like we're going to have an ad hoc march stepping off here. There's a crowd surge heading east.
We love Trump! 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 We love Trump!
Mike Pence, I hope you're going to stand up for the good of our Constitution and for the good of our country. And if you're not, I'm going to be very disappointed in you. I will tell
you.
Remember,
Mike Pence is an evangelical that they chose to be on the ticket to win over evangelicals. And now all of a sudden they said that he was a traitor and they wanted to hang him. Oh, this is not. Look at 12:54 p.m. This is peace. This is supposed to be a peace circle. This is what they call a peace circle. Look at this. How peaceful is this? Is this peaceful to you? Tell me when this is peaceful. Now imagine if these were black and brown people. Remember how Fox News and all of those, they had the invasions coming across the border, right? Pictures like this of people walking towards the southern border. Now imagine if this were black and brown people, what would happen? It would not be, oh, this is, look how peaceful this is. This is, look at this walk in the park.
Madam Speaker.
If you're joining us on, I see you guys on the TikTok. We're on YT, you can see all of it. With a timeline on the tube. At 1 p.m., they tried to come in to certify the election. And guess what was happening outside? Police officers were being beaten to within an inch of their lives. By MAGA idiots. Oh, look, breaking through barricades. Oh, peaceful.
Trying to breach and get to the Capitol.
Walk in the park. We're playing it all out for you. We're on the tube on YT if you want to join us. But make sure you smash the screen here.
42.
Yes, this is live. From my new ass on YouTube, on TikTok. 206. Oh, look, women in the crowd. Oh, look at them. Throwing objects at police officers. Traffic cones, flags. Thank you, Janelle. Thank you for pinning it to the top. That's where you go if you want to watch this live. Look, oh, they're breaking into the Capitol. They're breaking the windows and they have shields.
Breach of the Capitol.
Be advised, they're requesting additional resources on the east side as they have broken into that window and they're trying to kick it in.
Oh, they're trying to kick it in. These are peaceful. Oh, they were being ushered in, but they had to break windows.
Without objection, the chair declares the House in recess pursuant to Clause 12B of Rule 1.
The House had to recess at 2:18 p.m. because of this. Donald Trump tweeting, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution. Not saying stop it, he's tweeting out, encouraging them. Yes, is this the day of love? They want to ask, they're asking to bring out Pence so they can do what? They're trying to hang him. There's a gallows out there. Look, there's a gallows. There's a noose. Well, where do they get that noose idea? Isn't it interesting? Especially white people, let's be honest, always want to hang people. Anybody else get the notion? Never heard a black person saying, I want to hang somebody. Right, let's be honest, have you? Why do they always want to hang people? What is with that? The history of lynching in this country? That's their comfort zone. Now, whose house? Our house. Why? The election was completely legitimate by every court in the land, including the highest court, which is a conservative court, the Supreme Court. And yet and still, Donald Trump and MAGA, Donald Trump is lying to MAGA, and they are buying it because they are what? Cultist. Dig, dug, whatever. No, I did not. Get your facts straight. You guys are so ignorant. People are so ignorant. The MAGA people are so ignorant about facts. And lately, not like Republicans in general, but especially the MAGA folks, you guys are just dumb. Now they're beating up police officers. This is Michael Fanone, officer. That's his body cam.
They're all walking over now through the tunnels.
Being beaten up, had a heart attack. Samantha Pruitt says, white privilege being shown at its best, shaking my head. This is true.
We need to hold the doors of the Capitol.
Look at him. Oh, look. In a fight with a police officer. Back the blue. MAGA. Idiots. Fighting police officers. Yet they back the blue. It's all hypocrisy and lies. Oh, look how they're kicking this police officer's ass. Oh, my gosh. Poor officer. So much anger and hate in their hearts. Why is that? Because they think that they should be what? Prioritize and be the preeminent voice. That is supremacy. And they are white. White supremacy. That's what this is. That's what Donald Trump is playing on. Their fears that they, just like anybody else, have to have an equal station in America. They want to be prioritized. Our house. Imagine the privilege of that. Imagine the entitlement of that. Now, seriously, as I look at this, imagine that these were black and brown people. Now they're going into House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office.
So they want you to think. Capitol Police is going to start moving their resources inside.
Oh, did you see him throwing garbage cans at police officers? Now they want you to think, they want you to forget about this every year, but we're going to remind them every year of their own violence. And barbary. And how uncivil
with four members.
They act.
There's people.
Thank you, 32 Antoine.
They have no way out.
They have no way out. Officers are saying, I can't believe today Congress is going to certify the election of a president that was involved in an insurrection, asking for 11,780 votes. Fake elector scheme. Hasn't conceded to this day. Scary times. This is true.
It's up to us people now, the American people.
What are you ready to do?
One more time.
What are you ready to do?
And whatever it takes, I'll lay my life down if it takes.
That's how people have been brainwashed. Give me a little more volume, Andy, if you have it on the screen. We're coming in. Aren't these the people, F you, they're saying to police? Aren't these the people who say, hey, why didn't they just comply? Why aren't they complying with police officers here? It's hypocrisy. Why aren't they complying with police officers? You tell me. Because they don't think that they have to? Officer down. Do not forget about this, people. Nothing but white supremacy. I can't watch again. Peggy McGeary, you have to watch.
They were peaceful people. These were great people.
Donald Trump, they're peaceful.
Unbelievable, and I mentioned the word love. The love in the air. I've never seen anything like it.
That, how could Trump look at this footage and still say that it was a day of peace? He's delusional. They're delusional. I agree with you. How could this person be president again? This is the Vice President of the United States saying that there's a constitutional duty. And this is why Democrats are different in this moment than Republicans. Here it is.
Peaceful transfer of power is one of the most fundamental principles of American democracy. As much as any other principle, it is what distinguishes our system of government from monarchy or tyranny. Today at the United States Capitol, I will perform my constitutional duty as Vice President of the United States to certify the results of the 2024 election. This duty is a sacred obligation, one I will uphold, guided by love of country, loyalty to our Constitution, and my unwavering faith in the American people. As we have seen, our democracy can be fragile, and it is up to then each one of us to stand up for our most cherished principles and to make sure that in America, our government always remains of the people, by the people, and for the people. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
Wow, American patriot, Vice President of the United States, doing the right thing, as Mike Pence did, as a matter of fact, back in January of 2020. Same thing. He did his patriotic duty. and the duty that he was supposed to do as the vice president of the United States. And now Vice President Kamala Harris is going to do the same thing today.
Just a reflection of years past. Thanks for listening, everyone.
We don't want you on our team. You're too slow and fat.
This is weight bias.
Don't you care how you look?
Those with the serious disease called obesity face weight bias every day.
You're not the right fit for this job.
And blame themselves.
I wish I was different.
Weight bias hurts.
Let's stop weight bias.
Be part of the solution.
Go to stopweightbias.com. A public service message from Obesity Action Coalition.
The future depends on teachers. Every day, teachers are shaping our tomorrows, starting their students on journeys that will change the course of history. Right now, in a classroom somewhere in the United States, there's a teacher inspiring a future scientist who will make preventing pandemics their life's work, sharpening the mind of an aspiring environmentalist who will help combat climate change, and generating possibilities for a student who will be the first in their family to graduate college. It all starts with teachers who meet challenges with creativity, who reinvent education for the future, who work towards a school system that lifts up every child, regardless of race, income, or zip code, and who enable the full potential of our students, our communities, and our country. Explore a career that leaves a legacy you can be proud of. Shape the future. Teach. Learn more and receive free support at teach.org.
Hello, I'm Kevin Jameson, volunteer and president of the Dementia Society of America. Please request our free guide filled with facts about dementia. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Thank you.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today at Law and Disorder, we speak about the tremendous repression being carried out against those on campuses speaking out in support of Palestinians.
Professor Alan Wald from the University of Michigan discusses how this is all too reminiscent of the McCarthy era and what it means for academic freedom in America today.
Also on Law and Disorder, we speak to the author of the new book, Homeland Security, Myths and Monsters, about the Department of Homeland Security and what it's doing.
We speak with author Arun Kundani, who talks about how the Department of Homeland Security has become a repressive and bloated manifestation of government agencies.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. All across this country, academic freedom is once again under severe attack. Why? Because at colleges and universities, professors who dare to speak out in defense of the Palestinian people and condemn Israel's genocidal war against the Palestinian people are being censored, disciplined, and fired. And these attacks on academic freedom are not limited to actions by university administrators, but include those by the federal government as well. Visiting scholars, adjuncts, and lecturers without tenure have also had their contracts terminated or not renewed. Some had their classes suddenly canceled. Faculty members who espouse views contrary to official U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine have been criticized in ways that have trampled on their reputations and hurt their careers. As an excuse for this present-day McCarthyism, college and university administrators often claim their censorious actions are undertaken only on behalf of ensuring their Jewish students feel safe on campus. But there is a distinct lack of evidence to support their claimed motivation. And in fact, the largest pro-Palestinian actions on campuses are generally organized by Jewish groups, such as Jewish Voice for Peace. So today we've invited a professor from the University of Michigan to join us. We'll ask him about McCarthy-styled witch hunts against academic personnel, both in the past and again today. We'll learn how federal law is being misused as a mechanism of political repression against academia. And we'll discuss the role that controversy over slogans condemning Zionism play in this new attack on academic freedom, and what strategies are best employed today by the anti-war movement in the fight back against these attacks. As the ever more deadly Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine continues, our guest today is Professor Alan Wald, the H. Chandler Davis Collegiate Professor Emeritus at the University of Michigan, which I might add is my alma mater. Professor Wald has authored 8 books related to today's topic. He has been a socialist scholar since the 1960s and is currently an editor of the journal Against the Current, as well as a member of the editorial board of Science and Society. And Professor Wald was a founder of University of Michigan's Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine Committee. Well, Alan Wald, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, I'm happy to be here.
I stated in my introduction, Alan, faculty members at colleges and universities all across this country have been disciplined and fired and lost classes over statements they've made or protests they've attended condemning the Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine. And a couple of months ago, you gave a talk at a symposium at the University of Michigan in defense of Professor Mara Finkelstein of Muhlenberg College, who I think was the first tenured college professor in the country to be fired for her anti-Zionist and pro-Palestinian speech. So please tell us the facts of her case and why you claim it's an example of the attacks on academic freedom that we're going to discuss here today on Law and Disorder.
Well, there's a lot of details about the case that first came out in The Intercept. So somebody might Google Mara Finkelstein, The Intercept, and they will get a lot of details. But the essential point is that she sort of triggered the investigation into her situation by posting something on, I guess it was called Twitter, maybe it was by then called X, which was a poem by a Palestinian poet, a rap poet, which had some provocative language in it about shame Zionists and calling Zionist names and so on. She just posted the poem without comment. And this was caught by somebody who was monitoring her, either it was Instagram or X, and reported. And then that sort of triggered an investigation into any prior complaints as to whether in her classroom she had said things that had bothered students or in some other situation. And it did come up that she had previously posted negative remarks about the attempts of students on her campus, which is Muhlenberg College. It's a small college in New Jersey. There is a large pro-Zionist contingent there. They were raising funds for the IDF there, and they had a table, and she had complained about it on the internet. And then it came up that a student had simply complained about her being in the building because apparently, as I understand it, the Hillel, which has a relationship to many colleges and universities as the home for Jewish students, even though it's not a real academic unit. And Hillel has an awful lot of influence, and Hillel is also very biased. They do not allow students with anti-Zionist views to participate. So for a while, there was an alternative Hillel set up. In any event, the Hillel office seems to be in the same building as Mara. So a student in the Hillel office complained that he was afraid to be in the same building with Mara because she'd made these anti-Zionist speeches, which he regarded as threatening. And that was sort of the trigger. And they began to meet with her and threaten her. And then they decided that they would suspend her. And then they announced the equivalent of firing. I don't know exactly what the term used was. And it's not complete yet. She's not allowed to teach. And she's not allowed to use campus facilities and so on. And there seem to be some appeal processes. So one thing about dealing with universities that you may know is they don't release a lot of information. They claim that, well, it's a personnel issue. We don't speak on personnel. So we don't know everything that they have against her. But it's generally that kind of thing, which is very typical to many of the other cases, although there are variations. I don't know whether you follow all the cases. There are so many, and there are new ones every day. But, for example, the Steve Thrasher case at Northwestern University is interesting. He's an important professor in journalism there. And he apparently participated, well, said observing a demonstration, which many faculty members do, but participated in sort of setting up a protective line between the police and the students. And they've charged him with obstructing an officer because he participated in this protective line. And they've suspended his classes, and they announced they're going to investigate his social media. There's also the case of Richard Heyman. He's a lecturer at UT Austin, so he was fired, but he wasn't a tenured faculty. He was an 18-year lecturer, which, you know, it's a substantial investment in UT Austin. The police claim that at a demonstration, he shouted expletives and then made a threatening gesture with his water bottle, which I gather is a pretty dangerous weapon, you know, up against a cop with a gun and a club and a shield and a, you know, a water bottle. There's also Ruha Benjamin. She's a professor of African-American studies, very prominent. She's a MacArthur Fellow at Princeton University. Princeton has announced they're investigating her simply for her pro-Palestinian activism. Then you probably know about Catherine Frank. She's a Columbia University law professor. And she was on a radio show, one of your competitors, called Democracy Now! And she expressed concern that there are former Israeli soldiers studying at Columbia, and there had been an incident where some of these soldiers were accused of spraying student protesters in demonstration. And so she's now been threatened with the possibility of dismissal, and that's undergoing investigation. I could give you another bunch of names and so on, but that's the kind of thing that's happening around the country.
Well, Alan, talk to us about why you think that these, what you call witch hunts that are being carried out now, are reminiscent of witch hunts in the past. What common threads and common reasons are there for these attacks?
I think there are a lot of common threads. Other people have probably used the analogy. I'm drawn to it because I've done a lot of research in the 50s. I have my position here at Michigan is a chair named after H. Chandler Davis, who went to prison for refusing. He was a math professor, went to prison for refusing to cooperate in naming names, and eventually had to get his career restarted in Canada. There's no perfect analogy, but obviously the repression in the 1950s had to do with the international political situation. The government was trying to discipline the population to go along with the Cold War. And today it's also an international political situation. The government is trying to discipline the public to accept its support of the Israeli genocide, which, of course, is horrific and should be opposed. Another similar feature is the universities being a main target. They always see, well, first of all, universities are places where students and everybody protest a lot, and the vanguard of the Palestinian protests, obviously, on the campuses. But they can accuse the faculty of subverting and undermining and so on at the universities. Another similarity is the way that the federal government sort of triggers the situation by carrying out an investigation. So in the 50s, the post-war period, they sent FBI agents to the campus, and they alerted the presidents of the campuses that they were going after lists of faculty. They had the names. And here you saw the congressional hearings in, I guess, in April, where the college presidents were brought up and so on. So the federal investigations trigger this, and then the universities jump into action on their own and follow up. And of course, in both cases, they're aided by right-wing citizens who often put out lists of names. You've probably heard of Red Channels in the 1950s, which lists the names of all kinds of people, professors and others associated with the left, with communism. And today we have things like Canary Mission, which is only one of four or five different listings you can find online, which has hundreds of professors' names and calls them anti-Semites. And the proof is that they support the boycott divestment movement and so on. And then in addition to those, there are larger books that publicize the supposed subversives, the famous J. Edgar Hoover book, Masters of Deceit. Well, today you have the Heritage Foundation has a book called Project Esther, which has it's like a hallucinatory fever dream that there's a Hamas-led terror network throughout the United States funded from abroad and so on. And in both cases, also similar, is that the attack on the radicals is just a wedge to attack academic freedom and activism in general. There's a wedge issue. So in the 50s, the wedge issue was communist affiliation. And today the wedge issue is alleged anti-Semitism. This gives people leverage, gives the right leverage to make a broader attack against broader things. And that, at present, it's, of course, the DEI, the diversity, equity, inclusion programs that have replaced affirmative action. They want to destroy those. At the same time, keep in mind there are some differences. The 1950s witch hunt was not focused on current behavior. You know, today the accusations involve somebody making a statement like Mara Finkelstein on the social media, or claims that there's indoctrination going on in a classroom with critical race theory, or they're creating a hostile environment, or your course syllabus is not right. In the 50s, really, there was some investigation into your past, whether you signed a petition in support of Spain or something, but it was mainly about whether or not you had had some earlier affiliation with the Communist Party. They talked about conspiracy and espionage. They never proved that for a single faculty member, but they got them to on the stand and tried to show that they in the past had been connected with communism. Very few were still members. And then they did give them an escape route. You could escape the charge if you started naming names of other people and got them in trouble. And that would prove that you were no longer connected with communism. You couldn't, it wasn't enough to say, okay, I was, but I left, blah, blah. You had to go farther and prove it by naming names. I don't see that escape route at present. I mean, some of the people who've been accused of saying things on Instagram or whatever, have sort of backed down and apologized maybe, or they said they didn't mean what's being attributed to them. But that hasn't really gotten them off the hook. They're still being investigated. I think what disturbs me most about the parallels is that, you know, one happened earlier, so you would think that we would have learned lessons, what you should do and not do. And it doesn't seem like people have learned lessons, because the pattern is so far similar. You get a sign from the federal government, and then the administration jumps in and starts censoring people and so on. And most faculty members just run for cover. You know, they don't want to get in the line of fire. Others sort of pre-capitulate, which is a pretty dangerous thing. I mean, that's what brought Hitler to power, and that's what brought the 50s witch hunt, as you just give in too early and go along with it. The main forces that are opposing it right now that I see are the American Association of Universities Professors, which is playing a pretty good role, the Middle East Studies Association, also an excellent role, and some local faculty, staff, Palestine Justice Committees, such as we have here in Michigan, is playing a pretty good role. But, you know, by and large, people are not standing up to this. So that's concerning.
Well, Alan, as I also said in my introduction, it's not only college and university administrations that are targeting pro-Palestinian professors for their behavior or their demonstration or their chanting of a demand or their writing or what they might say in a classroom. The federal government as well is also doing so, are they not? And in this regard, perhaps you could explain what Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is all about and how it's being used really to censor or silence the pro-Palestinian professors on campus.
Right. I think Title VI is the main thing, but I don't want to ignore the fact that other things are happening. You know, universities are instituting a lot of new rules and policies about protests that we haven't seen before around supposed time and place restrictions. And of course, they're investigating course titles and syllabi and so on. But the Title VI thing is very important. Basic claim is Title VI, as you know, is under the Civil Rights Act. The argument is that you can't allow the harassment or discomfort of certain groups of people because it will interfere with their education. And so it's focused on the question of discrimination against a protected class. And it says that the protected class is due to race, color, or national origin. So they're claiming that when you attack a Zionism, you're attacking people of a national origin. That is, your anti-Zionist statement is not about politics, it's not about ideology, blah, 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 blah. It's really aimed at a protected class of national origin, which in a document that I've read, it says that refers to your country of birth or ancestry, as well as physical, cultural, or linguistic characteristics. So it seems to me kind of a stretch. I don't understand. First of all, they're claiming that if you attack Zionism, you're attacking Jews because somehow they're identical. That seems to me ridiculous, especially since most Zionists in the United States are Christians. I mean, the big movement is the Christian Zionists. There are 30 million of them. The total population of Jews is, you know, more like 5 million, probably not, you know, maybe three quarters of those consider themselves Zionists in a significant way and so on. So we're really talking about Christians when you talk about Zionists, but that's not the way they're treating it. The point is that if a claim is made under Title VI, which can be made by a student, a professor, a worker, and the university itself, if the claim is made that there's a harassment or hostile environment against this protected class, that is, in this case, Zionists, it can be punished because the government can take away millions of dollars of the federal funding. You know, University of Michigan, it's like $12 million. So if the government wants to go after a university or college where there's some kind of radical activity, there's a financial incentive for the university administration to find some mechanism to punish people. Say, oh, no, look, we're expelling these people. We're censoring them. We're following Title VI and so on. And as we see, a lot of these violations have to do with complaining about social media and also complaining about the content of courses. That's becoming more significant. Apparently, they're trying to make it seem as if a Title VI violation can come from teaching a class where you talk about Israel-Palestine in terms of settler colonialism, which is a very reasonable description of what's happened in Palestine. But they see this as an anti-Semitic critique, and they reinterpret this as supposedly meaning the annihilation of the Jewish population. Even though the major theorists of settler colonialism, such as Rashid Khalidi, you know, point out that, no, we're talking about a situation where two populations live in peace and equality. You know, removing the settler colonial aspect doesn't mean killing everybody who was involved in the settlement. And they also claim that this idea that the right of self-determination cannot take place when you're impinging on another population and kicking them out, that's an illegitimate self-determination, then you're saying that Jews don't have the right to self-determination, and they make that argument. So it's a combination of protesting against political critique and scholarship that they find threatening by announcing that it's anti-Semitic and harassing and creating an environment where students can't study properly, and therefore you have to censor.
Alan, I want to ask you about Zionism and what, in fact, is anti-Zionism. Is that anti-Semitic? We see that in central to the issues on college campuses, they're focusing on Palestinians' movement's attack on Zionism and the fact that Israel is a Zionist nation. And the movement's speech condemning Zionism is being equated with anti-Semitic speech. New York University has gone so far as declaring Zionist students and other Zionists a protected class on the NYU campus. And anyone condemning Zionism has been violating the rights of Zionist students. So can you tell us what in fact is Zionism, and is the anti-Zionist position anti-Semitic?
Yeah, this is absolutely crucial that people have to understand what these are. I mean, first of all, what is anti-Semitism? Well, it's being debated, and people are coming up with definitions, different definitions. And some people are avoiding definitions, which is really problematic. But basically, it's Jew hatred. And Jew hatred has come in different forms. There's a common history, I think, that before the Dreyfus case in, 1894, Jew hatred was based on religious belief that Jews killed Christ and so on. After 1894, it was clear that Jew hatred was based on some kind of conspiracy theory, a racial conspiracy theory. And there was a big change then. It's not that the earlier type completely died out, but that it was predominated by a racial conspiracy theory, which, of course, the Nazis developed to the highest point. I should say that anti-Judaism is something a bit different. That's when you deny the Mosaic Covenant and you argue that it should be replaced by another theology, such as the Christian Covenant and so on. So what is anti-Semitism? Well, I think if somebody says the Jews, can you put that on the radio? I don't know. Blank the Jews, that's anti-Semitic. And I think that if people make statements that promote the idea that there's a world Jewish conspiracy, you know, or negative generalizations about Jews, such as Jews have control over the governments of the world and media and banks and so on. Or if you have, you know, anti-Semitic symbols, such as the kind of caricatures that the Nazis put out, or anything linking Jews to the blood libel, that, you know, the belief that Jews like to kill non-Jewish children to have blood for their matzah, which, as I know, seems strange, but that was a widespread belief. And things that minimize the number of Jews died in the Holocaust. You know, well, there weren't that many, just a couple or something. So, you know, if a statement advocates or promotes violence against a Jewish person as a Jew or a Jewish institution simply because it's Jewish, I think that's clearly anti-Semitic, as well as, you know, assaulting, harassing, or threatening a person simply because you visibly identify them as Jewish because of the clothing they're wearing or some alleged physical feature and so on. But Zionism is something different. Zionism is a political mission of state-making that gives an advantage to Jews. So when you think of anti-Zionism, it's basically a political opinion. You're against a supremacist state. And you're not talking about Jews or Judaism. You're talking about a kind of state. And when people conflate the state argument as being a core belief in being a Jew, that's, you know, basically a fallacy. They seem to think you can't be against Zionism unless you're somehow against Jews as Jews. Now, of course, simply being an anti-Zionist, and that doesn't explain all of a person's politics. I mean, most of the people in the United States that I work with and people I admire, like, let's say, Khalidi or Edward Said and so on, they were for something. They were for a democratic state, for example, in the region. Some people think that maybe two states or some kind of federation can achieve equal rights. I don't know if that's possible at present. However, if you are arguing for a Jew-free region where all the Jews are chased out or killed simply because that's something else. You're linking something else to the anti-Zionism, but that's not anti-Zionism itself. We have to be careful that, you know, just because you're for something, it doesn't mean that you're something for something else. You have to articulate that something else. And I think it's really important for people to know the history of Zionism, because, I mean, I guess I'm very critical of those people who say, no, we can't debate the Zionists. We're normalizing it. If we enter debate, we're saying everything's equal or something. I think, you know, the case against Zionism is so strong, people should be confident that they can tell the history, because we know a lot about it, and just screaming that Zionism is racism or fascism, that's not going to change anybody's minds. But if you get them to read, I know this sounds heretical and shocking, but if you get them to read the basic books, there's sort of a consensus. Zionism didn't exist until 120 years ago. The Jewish religion appeared about 2,500 to 3,000 years ago. There's a big gap there. And when Zionism appeared, it was during a period of the rise of nationalism. It was a secular form of Jewish nationalism. The original Zionist founder, Herzl, was not religious. He was not interested in Hebrew. He was not interested in Yiddish. He wasn't interested in Jewish literature or anything. He just wanted to be normal. And he didn't like anti-Semitism. So he thought, if we guys have a state in Argentina, in Africa, or Palestine, you know, then we'll be respected. I mean, that was his basic idea. Anti-Semitism was an issue, but the response was kind of assimilationist, really, just to become like everybody else and have your own state. And it was generally rejected by Jews. There were other kinds of Jewish nationalism and so on that were almost as influential. And then it evolved when Herzl came on the scene, and he came up with a belief that he was religious, and he was motivated by theology, and he believed that Jews should relocate in Palestine, and that the Jews had this proprietary interest, although he wasn't advocating exactly colonization. He was just advocating a presence there. But then as you follow the history and the British take over with the Balfour Declaration, you see it is colonialism with a mother country in England sponsoring it. And then eventually by 1948, when a population breaks with England, it becomes a settler colonialism of a special kind and evolves into, you know, the situation we see today. So I think that by studying the history of Zionism, we can convince people. But I think that just denouncing it without explanation isn't that helpful.
As you study that history, you learn that people, when the country of Israel was formed, people like Albert Einstein said, I don't want anything to do with Zionism. I won't be the head of the country, as you've asked, and so forth. Well, in any event, this is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Michael Smith, and we're interviewing at the moment Professor Alan Wald from the University of Michigan. Well, Alan Wald, sadly, we are just about out of time, but I would like to hear any brief final thoughts you have on the topic we've been talking about today. And most assuredly, please let our listeners know where they can find some of your books and writings, websites, whatever you might direct them to that would be helpful in them understanding the topic we've been discussing today.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I would like to conclude by saying is we do need to organize and fight back. Collective action is the answer. Individuals can play a certain kind of role, but the political movement on the left has changed a lot since the new millennium with social media and so on. And we do see a lot of people participating simply by tweets and by Instagram and also, you know, by snarky remarks. And so I think we need national organizations that can unify people around clear political demands, and the demand should be against the U.S. government. And also on institutions with investments in the Israeli state. And of course, the demand should be to immediately stop funding and work for a permanent ceasefire and a just solution. I'm certainly not against people showing solidarity with Palestine and, you know, carrying Palestine flags and stuff like that. But the movement itself has to make demands on the government. And we need to promote also things like the BDS within that framework, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement. And we have to carry out educational activities about what is anti-Semitism really, and the fact that it's growing on the right is the problem. And we have to train people to clearly and competently explain to the public what is Zionism, not just shout slogans. I think we also need to have a clearinghouse of lawyers that can defend the victims of repression and organize defense committees nationally and unite people. I think Palestine Legal and the ACLU are doing some of this, but I haven't really seen it on a local level, but I haven't really seen a national effort. Then there's the global dimension. I mean, there are people in different countries with the same kinds of concerns. We have to figure out ways to link up to these movements in other countries. I've been on a few Zoom meetings with people in England and Western Europe, but I think there has to be a lot more of that. And on the other hand, we have to discipline ourselves. It's not helpful for people to do individually disruptive things. I mean, sometimes you can disrupt in a clever way. And of course, there are circumstances where, like, if, you know, Netanyahu were to come to the United States, yeah, you'd want to disrupt that. But some of these small-scale disruptions are not helpful. And we know that just one or two people acting poorly or with a terrible slogan, you know, like we need more October 7th against Israel or something, you know, Israel deserves October 7th. I mean, that's not very helpful.
I appreciate what you've just said. Would you please then quickly tell us where people can learn more about this, find your books, find your writings and so forth?
Well, I've been writing articles for the Journal Against the Current, which gets circulated. They appear on Portside. I said some were just published by the British Labour Party, the Jews in the Labour Party, and stuff like that. I mean, they circulate on the internet. If you look up the topic and the name, you know, I tend to rely on 972, on Al Jazeera. This is good stuff in the London Review of Books. I like Adam Schatz's writings. There's a lot of good stuff out there. And of course, the Rashid Khalidi's books are terrific. There are a number of Palestinian scholars who are doing great stuff on this.
Thank you, Alan Wald, for being with us today here on Law and Disorder. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, to listen to your ideas and your views, and we encourage our audience to follow up with as you have suggested.
Okay, thanks. Glad to talk to you guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Department of Homeland Security was created in 2002. Trump has appointed Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, to be its new head. The DHS has consolidated previously separated departments and brought into a single sprawling entity 22 pre-existing agencies. It became the nation's third largest government department. Today, it has a budget of over $100 billion and employs a quarter of a million people. Every danger is now conceived as a threat to, quote, homeland security. As governor, Noem sent South Dakota National Guard troops to Texas 8 times to fight what she called the...
People say our country is facing polarization like never before. At Inform Your Community, we're on a mission to change that narrative. We believe that even in disagreement, we can find common ground and work towards solutions with respect. At Inform Your Community, we know the best way to talk about difficult topics is to talk about difficult topics. We're here to educate, bridge gaps, and encourage dialogue by providing engaging, welcoming, and meaningful events that discuss the timely civic issues that matter to you most. At informyourcommunity.org, we foster an environment of civility and respect. Here, we value productive dialogue over hostility and strive for understanding. To learn more about a movement that believes in the power of respectful discourse to heal our communities and address crucial issues that you care about, please visit informyourcommunity.org. We have a motto at Inform Your Community: civility, not hostility.